Talbi up to Isidore, who was all on his own. Isidore! All over now! A winning return to the Premier League and then some for Sunderland.
And welcome to the Sound of Football podcast. I'm Graham Sibley, and as ever, I'm joined by Jan Bilton.
Hello.
And Terry DeFellin.
Hello.
And should that be that it's last season's Jan Bilton that we've got joining us this week? Hello, last season's Jan Bilton. You're still full of beans, aren't you?
I very much am. I'm not down like next season's Jan Bilton. He's all miserable and worried, but I'm enjoying life. Yeah, very much enjoying life.
Enjoying life because Sunderland returning to the Premier League after 8 years did what the promoted sides last season couldn't manage until October, and that is win a game in the Premier League. It's astounding. Not just win. Win it by 3-0. Can you remember if Sunderland have ever won a Premier League game 3-0?
I'm sure they have, but not for a long, long time. Are you going to pull that stat out? You know this?
No, I don't actually.
I thought you were going to hit me with a surprise.
Well, I normally would, but I thought this could be a fool's errand, this. I mean, like, I could be just ploughing through loads and loads of stats, never to find something like that. You'd think it would stand out, wouldn't you? But I'm sure it's there somewhere. But no, a fantastic result, wasn't it? And Terry, how shocked were you when you saw the goals raining in on Saturday?
Shocked? Football? Well, probably no. I couldn't say I was shocked. But, I mean, I was delighted. One, because West Ham. But also because I just thought, I bigged them up so much in the last podcast for having been so bold in the transfer market that it was nice to feel as though my initial instincts were correct. With the massive caveat that there is a very long way to go.
Of course.
But, I mean, what a way to start what is, let's face it, it's going to be a difficult season for Sunderland. But what a way to start and a way to galvanise that home crowd. Good grief. It was really refreshing. It contributed to a nice, lively, sunny start to the Premier League season. I felt positively buoyant after having watched the highlights of that and seeing that result.
I don't think it could have gone any better. It was an absolute fairy tale, considering we didn't go out kicking and screaming from the Premier League last time, did we? We disappeared with a little plop, and that was it. Poof, gone. But we came, I think, roaring back on Saturday. It was a full house. The sun was shining. We had a host of new signings mixed with some of the guys that got us promoted as well. There was a glorious tifo on display of Lord Lambton skewering the Lambton worm, as he did back in the day. So it definitely happened. A bit of a tight first half, 0-0. And then as Sunderland and West Ham went for it, started to create more space. But in the first half, I mean, Bowen had a good chance very early on, as did Diarra, new signing for Sunderland. But, you know, there were some great headers by Maenda and Dan Ballard, again, at the same end, as he scored against Coventry. And then to round it all off, when West Ham were looking to they were really piling on the pressure and looked like they were going to at least get one back and set it for a grandstand finish, Sunderland counterattacked. And Isidore, who can get a shot off from anywhere, did really well to finish it. So, yeah, it was a tough game, but it felt like we blew them away in the second half. They certainly were wide open for the last goal because they were looking for one themselves. Mm. But, yeah, it was fantastic. All three of the goal scorers were players that got us promoted last season, and all three of the players who provided those opportunities were new players that came in. So there's nice symmetry there. And we've got Burnley next week. So that could bring us right down to earth, because, you know, 3-0 in your first game is brilliant. You're right, Graham. No one did that. None of the promoted clubs did that last season till October. Burnley will be a tough test. They'll be licking the wounds after their defeat against Spurs. But if we go to there and lose 3-0, we're back where we started. And that could actually happen. So, it's a long way to go, but having 3 points in the bag and having that occasion to be as wonderful as it was, it was just fantastic. It was a really, really great Saturday. I really wish I could have been there. Apparently, it was amazing.
It looked it, really did. But, Terry, the numbers, though, suggest that it was a very, very, very close game. Sunderland had 37% possession. Not surprising when a team takes the lead, though, is it really, when they can just sit back? But also, they only out XG'd West Ham by a fraction. They only had 0.68 XG. So they were clinical, took their chances. Those headers were fantastic. But it shows you how tight the game actually was. Narrow margins as ever, but to come away with a 3-0 win is fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the XG figures could be a little bit worrying in view of the fact that they were less than one on both sides. And to score three, I mean, the worry is that, you know, are you overperforming? But it's just one game.
Yeah.
It really is pointless looking at XG stats for that. I mean, I don't know what Burnley's XG against Tottenham was, but I'm going to suggest it wasn't a lot. But I think you're probably more likely to think about the way that Burnley are supposed to have been set up as a football team to defend, and then worry about what, you know, get more insight that way, and then worry about the game that they had. I think that Sunderland clearly have set themselves up to score goals, and they've brought in players to be able to do that too. They will look to attack and be aggressive this season. And we'll know a little bit more about what their chances are, the kind of quality of chances that they're creating in the weeks to come. That's the great thing about the opening round of the season, the first couple of games of the season, is that you don't know a great deal. Although, I mean, there are probably some results that you look at and you do wonder if there is some kind of portent. And that would also include, obviously, you know, the aforementioned Burnley. And I can understand Jan's perfectly understandable. Reaction and concerns about facing Burnley, but I think they were pretty average against a Tottenham team that is, you know, certainly improved under Thomas Frank, but that was a bad result. And losing to Tottenham at Tottenham, okay, yeah, that can happen, but 3-0 has a kind of ring about it, doesn't it? And their narrative is, you know, they went up on their defence, not on their attack. Mm. And so what's the plan? If that's the plan for the rest of the season, then...
Yeah, I think it was Jan that said on this podcast about looking at Burnley going up and knowing what's happened in the past, about how quickly they could concede the same number of goals as they conceded in the whole of last season. I think we were discussing whether or not it would happen before the October international break, and you wouldn't be surprised if it did. They actually posted 0.93 XG, so more than Sunderland did. But they did concede 2.32. So they were perfectly within their rights to concede three goals. Maybe feel a bit hard done by not to get something in return there. Look at us talking about XG. Look at me talking about XG. I think it's just interesting if you want signs and portents, because we got so little to go on, haven't we, on the first weekend, that you've got to caveat everything you say, haven't you? But it was a good weekend, because for us, my finger is almost poised over the hot chocolate button, but I can't press it because, unfortunately, Palace didn't win. But all four of our teams, Arsenal, Sunderland, Palace and Whiteleaf, all had clean sheets. So that doesn't happen very often. Unfortunately, I don't have a jingle for all of us having clean sheets. And Terry almost won. It was almost won, wasn't it, against Chelsea? Had a goal disallowed, didn't you?
Yeah, I was only able to switch on to the Palace game after the first 20 minutes. And I saw it came up on my flash scores that they'd scored. And I thought, yeah, they scored. And then when I was able to sit down and watch the game, it was back to 0-0. And I thought, VAR has done something, hasn't it? And then I saw it at halftime. And it was all those, really? That's the thing, is it? Okay, I didn't know that. But that's my fault for not knowing that. And it's kind of Mark Gahey's fault for not knowing that. All right, I'll say it. I mean, referees just hate goals. They just hate goals. It's like, but if it happens to me, if I'm on the other side of it, then I'm like, ha ha ha, you broke the rules. Yeah, you know, it's not a goal. So I am a bit hypocritical here, but It just seems to me like really, really good goals are not being scored because of what appear to be, in my opinion, technical infringements rather than actual infringement. Mm. But anyway, that's a completely pointless argument, massively one-eyed, and there it is. Because if it happens the other way around next week against Forest, I shall be delighted, you know. So I shall say no more about that. I thought Palace did well to come away from the Bridge with a point, because I think you always do well. I think to shut out Chelsea for the first time since the season before last, I think, is impressive. But beyond that, there's not a great deal to say about that match. There was an underlying tension as a Palace fan, but I think any neutral watching it would have probably felt the game was a bit dull. So I'm content to leave it there. I'm off to watch the Conference League game on Thursday, and I'm really looking forward to it. That, for me, is the big game.
Against? Come on, Terry. You did this in warm-up. You got it perfectly. And
I know. Before we were warming up, I got it absolutely perfectly, but now I've forgotten who it is.
It begins with an F.
Oh, for fuck's blood.
almost. Frederikstad. Frederikstad.
Even I remember that.
Yeah. Okay. Apologies. Yeah. So they're playing Frederikstad. They finished pretty high up, obviously, in the Eliteserien. I mean, like most people, I don't know anything about Eliteserien. I mean, I know a bit about Bodø/Glimt because everyone knows a bit about Bodø/Glimt. But I mean, beyond that, I don't know too much about them. They got beat by Midtjylland in the Europa League qualifier to drop down into the Conference League playoff. And yeah, as I said from last week, it's a bit irksome that we have to play a playoff because we're in the Conference League, whereas if we'd been in the Europa League, we would have gone straight through to the group stage. But that's how it is. And I am looking forward to Palace's first proper UEFA match. Technically, our first one was against a Turkish team about 20 years ago in the Intertoto. But this will be, it's our first proper UEFA match. And it's a sold-out stadium, so the Palace public are really looking forward to the game. And, hopefully it'll be a really, really good result. And for me at the moment, that still feels very much like the more important fixtures for me right now. And I suspect for most Palace fans, that's probably the case.
Yeah, got Forest in between those playoff games. That's a fixture computer just messing with you, isn't it?
Isn't it? Yeah. Well, Steve Parish intimated was of the strong impression that the reason why UEFA got involved in this decision was because of a complaint registered by Forest. I'm not actually certain that's the case, because it was being reported only a few days after the cup final. Anyway, I think it is probably fair to say that Forest did stick their oar into this, and I would suspect that that's created some bad feeling. And particularly given that Palace uncovered evidence that, in fact, Marinakis had not actually put his paperwork in on time himself, but the reality is that he had put his paperwork in. So I don't know. It could all get a little bit silly, and there could be some beef in that game. But I do think it is probably worth bearing in mind that this is not Morecambe and Sheffield Wednesday's level of crisis, and we should probably just bear in mind that these are actually, for both clubs, pretty much, well, maybe not for Forest because they've literally won the European Cup, but certainly for Crystal Palace, these are the best of times, and I hope that that is what's remembered. With that said, I really hope we fucking stick it to those cunts. Sorry.
Snitches, I really hope. Bitches.
Yeah, I mean, talk about shitting when you eat. I mean, it's a league, guys. We're literally in league together. The competition is on the pitch, right? But anyway. That's clearly not how it is. I hope we really stick it to them, because I think it was really, because I just really do. I hope we do.
That's perfectly fine. This is your podcast, yep. Terry, as much as anything. And so you're going to allow it. Yes.
In a strong field, that's the finest take I've ever heard, Terry.
Ever. Yes, very much so. Well, you say that there wasn't a lot to talk about your game. There's probably even less to talk about in Arsenal's opener against United. Very tense for me, watching us basically hold on in the end. Old Trafford has not been an easy place, even in banter-era Man United. We've struggled. We've got a couple of wins recently there, but only by the odd goal and hung on for those wins. And it proved to be the same again. The new signings came in. Didn't really do too much. And of course, Arsenal scored off their first corner of the season. Hurrah! Yeah, it was enjoyable because it was a win. And yeah, sort of result that we may not have got in years by. So that's some positive for me. But yeah, early days, can't really judge anything on that performance for Arsenal, I think.
Man United played as well as I've seen them in a very long time.
Yeah.
Their new signings looked like they worked really well. I mean, Mason Mount, a fit pre-season.
Yeah.
And it showed.
Yeah.
And Bermo, I knew would be a really, really terrific signing for them because, you know, he's a really good player and he knows how to play English football and he loves Man United. And Cunha eternally surprises me because when the Hertha Berlin Cunha that I saw wasn't really all that much. But he's clearly come on in leaps and bounds. And I was loving it how he was getting up in the grill of those Arsenal players. I mean, United need players. Well, all clubs need players like that. And United have got one there. And you have to say, actually, if that's going to be the way United play, then once they start finding the back of the net, they are going to have a, you know, again, early days, but they are set for a good season.
Yeah, I did think, though, that if Arsenal could counterattack as well as Bournemouth did on Friday night, then we would have scored quite a few goals because they were open at the back. Yep. And our through balls just weren't connecting or we weren't being able to control them properly. And if someone did control it up there, any pass out to the wings just got snaffled out. Now, that was as well is that United did work hard getting back, but they were stretched. I don't know if their business is done. They can't have much more money to spend, really, on midfielders. I don't know if they're actually lining anyone up at the moment.
Well, I don't think that there is a defensive midfielder that they can sign, really, that would really fit the bill. I doubt very much there's anybody out there that they wouldn't have to develop. I don't think there's anyone established who is available and who would probably fall within you know, their PSR requirements because they would have spent a lot of money. Well, I mean, Cesco would have cost an awful lot of money. Yeah, it's certainly not a finished article, absolutely. And they will concede goals, just as it would appear Liverpool will concede goals. If that's the Bournemouth game was anything to go by, I mean, there's a nice big fat hole in the middle of that Liverpool park, isn't there?
Yes.
For pacey number nines to run into. And, you know, English football appears to be about the long ball these days as well. So could be really very interesting season in that respect.
Oh, exactly, yeah. Tottenham, a long ball club now, which is interesting. But no, I thought that Liverpool game was fascinating. After the Charity Shield, and about how vulnerable they were on transition, then all of a sudden they let a two-goal slip from balls that were given away just outside the opponent's penalty area.
Mm.
That seemed worrying. If I was a Liverpool fan, yes, you outscored Bournemouth, well done, but leaving it to injury time on the opening day of the season when you've spent so much money, that does seem a bit worrying. I would think so anyway. But again, first game of the season. Well, I think that gives everyone a good idea of the opening weekend. Obviously, the transfer window is still open, so there could be more business yet to be done. I think Forest were snapping up a couple of signings today, even, I think. And Sunderland made another signing as well yesterday from PSG, didn't you?
They did, which is just stick them with the rest. It's got a big pile of new players. I don't know much about the new signing, to be fair. It only dropped yesterday. Defensively is where we need to strengthen, clearly. We started with defenders that started last season, so it makes sense that we boost our defensive abilities.
And one thing, Terry, about that disallowed goal was it would have been a great way for Eze to sign off his Palace career, wouldn't he, before he moves off to Spurs?
Yeah, I guess so. If you want to whack me with a pain stick there, I guess. Oliver Glasner insisting that he's going to play in the Conference League game on Thursday and that the situation I don't think is as cut and dried as people think it is. I don't know why he's going. I do know why he's going to Spurs. He's going there because they're probably giving him a very large amount of money. But I know Spurs are in the Champions League this season, but I'm not. I would have thought Eze was good enough to play for a regular Champions League club that will contend for. I would have thought Lou would have been good enough to play for Arsenal,
yep.
Who he used to be a youngster for. He was an Arsenal youth player. It just doesn't feel like it's the kind of step up that is worthy of an England international who plays that well. I mean, I realise I'm throwing massive shade on Spurs, but I hope Spurs will understand that why I'm saying that is that, you know, this is a team that finished, fifth from bottom last season. They are going to be much better this season, but they're really only looking at one season in the Champions League. It's far to see Spurs finishing fourth. With or without Eze. So from an ambition point of view, it's like, what's the game plan here? I mean, obviously, I do appreciate that there'll be an upgrade in money, and that is important. I'm not saying it's not important, but it just feels like why weren't there other clubs, maybe, you know, perhaps more successful clubs in recent years with more, you know, that he would have gone to? I think a lot of it is because he's 27, you know, and the old transfer amortization and all that stuff. I mean, the sell-on value is not great for Eze. And I guess Spurs need players who are established talents right now in order to be able to push on and do something. And so that I can see from their point of view why it's an excellent signing and a really, really good fit. But for me, it seems a bit of a shame. But a lot of that is a measure of how you think about Palace now since they've won the cup. Because my opinion of Palace is different now since they won the cup. But in fact, in reality, it isn't that different. So perhaps I'm being a little bit conceited there. Anyway, best of luck to him if he goes. I mean, he's been great. And I hope he's successful at Tottenham, if indeed it happens. But then again, I hope that we lose Gehi instead and that Eze becomes a captain and stays for the rest of his career. That's what I really hope. Of the two, I'd be happier if Gehi went. I think he can go.
Okay. I'm just interested to find out what sort of signing he would be going from Palace to Tottenham. Is he going to be like a John Bostock? Is he going to be a Wayne Routledge? Probably more likely to be a Chris Armstrong, I think. One decent season and that'll be it, yeah?
You do have to look at the history books. And the thing is, you could do this with every club, couldn't you? And you could look at the various careers that have been ruined. But Tottenham did go through an ever so slight period of flushing young players' careers down the toilet. But there's no reason to assume why that would happen. And again, Eze is an established England international and a top-class player. So I'm sure he knows what he's doing. And as I say, I wish him well. Evil, albeit through gritted teeth.
I think he'll stay, actually.
I think he'll stay as well.
Got a sneaky feeling about this. I think it would have happened by now. But hey, who knows? By the time this goes out, you know, I could be doing some hasty editing tomorrow. it would probably happen as soon as I press send, wouldn't it?
I'll type Eze into Google and press refresh every couple of seconds.
What about the Isak situation then, Jan? What the hell's going on there? Are you looking at it, laughing up your extra wide laughing sleeve and going, ha, 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 Newcastle can't keep their players happy. Ha, 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 he wants to go to Liverpool because he's fed up of them.
That's exactly right. I went to the tailor and I said, I need this to be a lot wider than it already is. Stick a new hem in that. Yeah, it's amazing. You saw on Saturday that they weren't the team that they were last season going forward because they don't have that bite up front. They don't have Isak up front. So he's clearly trying to engineer a move away from Newcastle to Liverpool. But, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes. Eddie Howe seems to be playing it quite cool. And he's quite the gentleman and doesn't give too much away. But effectively, Isak's on strike, isn't it? He's saying, from what we're hearing, he's saying, even if I can't get this move to Liverpool, I'm never playing for Newcastle again. So let's just take that as true for a minute. What is he going to do? This is a bit like the Rodwell thing at Sunderland a few years ago, if you remember. They couldn't get rid of him, and he refused to play. And you kind of stuck in this impasse for a while, and it took a change of ownership, actually, to find a way through, which effectively was just paying him off. But you were talking about much smaller amounts of money then, relatively large amounts of money for the club involved for Sunderland. But, you know, you're talking about a well north of £100 million player here who can do a job, but is refusing to do it, certainly for Newcastle. I really can't see a way back for him. You heard some of the understandable chants from my cousins north of the Tyne there about him being greedy. You can understand a young player wanting to move to another club to progress himself. He's done really well at Newcastle. Is he going to be able to win the Champions League with Newcastle? Probably not. Has he got more chance at Liverpool? Probably. But there's a way of conducting yourself and a way of dealing with it. And I think going on strike, alienating the entire fan base who love you and up to the end of last season revered him as high as any of their legends. There's no way back from, I can see. It's going to take some kind of Alistair Campbell-esque spinnery to get him back in the good books amongst the Geordie faithful. And as well as that, if you're Liverpool and you've seen the way he's behaved, if indeed he has behaved that way, are you going to want a player that's like that? He can do it to Newcastle. He can do it to you when Real Madrid come knocking or something like that. Yeah, he's not covered himself in glory. But I sense we'll go on to talk about this in a little bit more depth and the wide-ranging implications of this and other matters. But feels like the club needs some protection from this.
Mm.
Because in this particular scenario, the clubs have got lots of protection and players don't have enough in a lot of cases. But you know, Newcastle haven't really done anything wrong here as far as I can see, other than trying to hold on to what is a decent asset. And, you know, the player and maybe his representatives have really, you know, soured this, really. And you know, as much as I don't feel sorry for Newcastle, if that was any other club, it was my club. Well, it was my club a few years ago. I mean, you're completely powerless. The player does not have to turn out. And you're left with this, you know, incredibly valuable asset that's just rotting there, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, there has been some problems behind the scenes at Newcastle. They've lost quite a lot of senior execs there. So at the top, there has been a lot of movement, a lot of people in temporary jobs there, and maybe the systems in place there for players having to renegotiate contracts has not been as smooth as it usually is. So there could be that level in there. But Terry, I mean, you followed Isak's career pretty much all the way along since he came to Dortmund. Is this anything you've seen in the past from him?
Not in the slightest, no, as far as I can make out. I'm just trying to remember the circumstances with which he arrived from Dortmund, but I don't remember them being in any way controversial. I think that it was felt that they'd signed a really, really good player, and they had. As I said last week, he didn't quite develop that much at Dortmund and had really earned his spurs at Sociedad. But there's nothing to suggest that there was that anything, you know, weird or strange had happened with that guy. It is very, very peculiar. As you said, Greg, we're not privy to the ins and outs of this. So we don't know whether or not there's been any kind of provocation or any kind of justification that might explain why Isak would take such a drastic step to break protocol in such a way as to refuse to play. It's an extremely risky thing to do. If Newcastle stick to their guns, you know, he could spend a significant portion of his career, of what is a short career, not playing football. There's a World Cup coming up as well. And, you know, this is not a good time to be doing this. On the other side of it, in general, not in necessarily in this instance, but in general, players are, I think, entitled to a great deal more freedom, more say about their movements and who they work for and who they choose not to work for, because most of us do. Most of us have a notice period. I appreciate that contracts are contracts and that the transfer system is what it is and it's established. And so I'm not excusing Isak for the decisions that he's taking. And I suspect that I think he's been poorly advised. But in a broader sense, I can understand why a worker becomes frustrated tied to a contract that they want to get out of. And I have sympathy for that point of view. But when you consider that the Newcastle fans, I mean, they had a choreo up for that guy in the middle of last season during the game. They absolutely loved him. I just feel so tone deaf. I think it would have been better if he had maybe gone public and said, look, I want to leave. But for the Newcastle fans, it's been great to me and I love you. And as long as I wear the shirt, I'll give you my all. But you need to know that I want to leave. And, you know, you might even find then that, you know, life might be an awful lot easier. Maybe we'll move. But who am I to offer that kind of advice? It just feels like a really, really bad move for him. And it could backfire terribly, you know, and be really, really costly if Newcastle really stick to their guns. But maybe he just doesn't feel that they will. He's confident that they'll cave. But at the very least, they'll send him out on loan. But if I'm Liverpool, I would like to get some clarification on the motivation behind what doing what he's doing for exactly the reason that Jan's out.
This is quite rare that we see players go on strike. We see players unhappy and certainly threaten to strike. I mean, people like Paul Scholes, Wayne Rooney went through that when they were negotiating contracts, but they still played through that. And they remained legends at the club, so still without souring their reputation there. But you do think this is a dangerous move. I do wonder if this move could become more common given the decisions that have been made recently in the courts in Europe regarding Lassana Diarra, where he has won at the European Court of Justice. He's won his case against FIFA and the Belgian FA with regards to the transfer system being unjust and unfair to players. Now, it's a complicated story, but the gist of it is that a player or a club can break a contract. They can dissolve a contract between them. It's a last resort, but they can. But if a club does it, they know pretty much exactly how much they are liable for to the player if they decide that they want to stop the contract 2 years early. If a player decides that, it's not. And their liability could be anything, depending on what transfer value the club deems that they have coming to them. And this was the problem that Diarra had, was the fact that when he was out of contract, as soon as he tried to sign for a club in Belgium, Charleroi, all of a sudden they're liable for a transfer fee, which they didn't want to pay because they're a small Belgian club and probably couldn't afford it. So now you've got the situation where the European Court of Justice says, well, actually, no, these contract terms are unfair. And now Diarra today has now started a €65 million case against FIFA and the Belgium FA for compensation. And with this court's decision, there are thousands of players across Europe who could also be in line for compensation for having to pay out unfairly when pulling out of the contract. Now, it's a very, very complicated decision, and obviously there are aspects of the case that are unique to that case. But potentially here, we're seeing that there could be thousands of footballers claiming compensation, largely from FIFA, but could also be from local FAs. I know there is a class action suit going up against FIFA, along with the German, French, Belgian, and I think the Dutch FAs as well, all together, that could run into billions. And someone's got to foot that bill. Terry, end of days?
Well, it seems unlikely that it's end of days, but it does feel as though there's a slow sort of like movement against the current transfer system. Since Bosman, this principle of player movement, I think, has been very much center of people's minds. I think the idea that players can and should be allowed to move around out of contract makes sense. And in contract, normally if you sign a contract with an employer, even if it's a short-term contract with an employer, there are methods of getting out of that contract on both sides. The worker and the employer can terminate the contract, usually, and it's usually a notice period. And sometimes it's a month, sometimes it's a week, sometimes it's 6 months. But there's not really any kind of get out for footballers to get out of a contract if they want to move on. And this is helpful to the clubs because it locks down the value and preserves the value of the player, because they often see players as assets and commodities rather than human beings. But as human beings, if a player says, well, you know what, I play for a big club, but this bigger club over here wants me to sign for them and I want to go, so I'm going to invoke my contract and I'm going to leave. This is impossible. But I would suggest to you that that shouldn't be impossible. I think that workers should be allowed to do that. And that's what they are. They are workers. So it could, if this goes a certain way, it could end up like that. But I don't feel sufficiently legally experted to be able to know whether or not that is actually a likely outcome of this particular case. More, it could, however, be another marker in what is actually an inevitable outcome. But my opinion is this, is that I think that FIFA should at some point recognise the direction of travel, and that sooner or later somebody is going to win a case, which means that they can quit halfway through their contract and go somewhere else. It might take them a month or 6 months to give the rest their notice, but they can do that and leave. And so the best thing to do is to then restructure the transfer system to be able to preserve the value of those clubs and not cause a massive financial club black hole that no amount of Club World Cups are going to pay for.
Hmm.
The buyout clause, if you've managed to engineer that into the contract that you sign with your new club, should help you get out if you've achieved a certain level and certain value, obviously. So that's in place at the moment. I don't disagree with what you're saying. I think if a player's incredibly unhappy for whatever reason, then there should be a mechanism that can enable them to depart. But if you're going to have something like that, or let's say, you know, like the rest of us have, a notice period, then the impact that that has on transfer fees is huge, because, you know, you're not going to spend £150 million on Isak knowing that he can leave with whatever terms are agreed. You know, he can leave on a notice period after a year or whatever like that. It does feel slightly artificial, football, because you move from one club to, they're effectively purchasing your contract, aren't they? They're buying you out of your contract and then you are tied into a new contract. We're all tied into contracts with our employers, but you can exercise the right to leave effectively whenever you want. And footballers don't have that. So it is quite unique in that. And I'm sure the usual voices will talk about how much money they get paid and things like that, which is, okay, that is a point. But if someone is massively unhappy with where they are, then no amount of money is going to compensate for that. And as well as that, not just that kind of the mental burden, but if you want to go and better yourself because you realize that maybe I've arrived at this club, I've become a much better player, and I think I could go and play at a much higher level. So therefore, I want to do that. But I'm unable to do that. I'm unable to progress myself, develop myself. And that does feel a bit unfair. So there needs to be something that works for everyone where the club has some kind of protection, so they're not in a situation like Newcastle are now. But at the same time, you haven't got a situation where Diarra was unable to sign for a new club through effectively no fault of his own, just because of the way the rules were set up. So there needs to be a lot of thought about that, because the fallout could be huge. Mm. Suddenly a player that you just paid £100 million for last week can leave, you know, let's say after a year. So the value of players will nosedive. And effectively, that could also impact players. So, you know, it could be a quid pro quo, couldn't it? You know, you can have this freedom, but it does mean that you don't get the rewards, the golden handcuff. So there's a bit of balance there. Which one do you want? I certainly believe that employees should have the right to move on and not be tied down to something that is unfair, unless they feel that they want to be tied down to that because the golden handcuffs are okay.
The clubs themselves and FIFA themselves are the architects of this situation for being so bloody obstreperous in the first place. If they had been flexible with Diarra and said, you know what, this is a rough deal, mate. You're playing for a Russian club that is on its uppers. It's all going horribly wrong and this guy needs to move on. We should just like make this happen. But let's not be dicks about this. Let's just let this guy go. FIFA were probably saying to him, like, you know, this is a somewhat exceptional circumstances. You should just let this go. And like, but no, they didn't. They folded their hands and they didn't do it, which is classic bosses. This is what bosses do. They just like stick to their guns because they're worried about precedent and the thin end of the wedge and the other such rubbish. And now they have put themselves into this position where they are vulnerable. And again, it's unlikely, but they're moving the boulder closer to the day where the transfer market collapses and then everybody's fucked. And of course, they won't see it coming. They won't plan ahead for it. It'll be a complete and utter catastrophe. The best thing to do would be to invent time travel, go back in time and change their minds. Diarra wouldn't have gone away. I don't imagine he's a crusader. He just wants his money back. We talk about the money that players earn, and they do earn an awful lot of money, but that does not entitle employers to ride roughshod over their workers' rights. And also, if a player is being paid £50,000 a week for playing for a middle-class Premier League club, and then the top-class Premier League club comes along and says, I'm going to pay you £150 a week, that is a lot of money to turn down.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of money to have blocked from you. In my opinion, a player would have every right to say, how dare you stop me from earning that kind of money? I am doing this job for 10, 15 years max. So you're absolutely entitled to go for as much money as you can. You know, it's hard as a supporter to watch good players leave your club. But my God, you know, if Eze is being paid like double wages or a third, even a third more than what he's earning at Palace, he's in for a fortune. Who am I to stand in the way of somebody earning that kind of money? You know, I mean, like they put an awful lot of themselves, as do their families, into getting this. And most of them don't make it. So the ones that do, they should absolutely make as much hay as they can. And just because a club says, oh, no, you can't go because we need you. Well, sorry, that's just not good enough, I'm afraid. So something needs to be done, and balance is the key. And as is often the case with football, there is just no balance whatsoever, as is the case with capitalism in general, which is why it should be smashed.
Well, there is that. Yeah, people will say players are too greedy, but there is a hell of a lot of money and it's got to go somewhere. And I saw one lawyer who was against the whole Diarra thing saying about, well, you know, 60% of clubs' money goes on players. Yeah, good. Where else is it meant to go?
Good.
Yeah, Who else is that? That is the correct ratio. Yeah.
These are the guy. We're nothing without these guys.
No.
Football doesn't exist without these
there
guys.
There is no show without these guys.
People say football is nothing. Football without fans is nothing. No, football without players is nothing.
Yeah. And I think we actually saw during lockdown that football without fans actually still happens, doesn't it? They just pipe in the noise.
It's not an ideal state, you know, to be in. In an ideal world, it would be better if fans were there. But I think we're all agreed, yeah. Football is about players, and all the money should be about players. If it all goes to players, brilliant. The only other people who should get more money is probably referees, because, like, without them, we haven't got football either.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though they are useless and myopic and anti-goal.
Anti-goal.
Anti-goal referees. More money for anti-goal referees. That's the takeaway from this one, guys.
The thing that annoys me about, and you hear kind of working class Tory types talking about, sorry to get political, but Terry started it, going on about how much football has appeared. But then you go, all right, well, then by the same rationale, so somebody makes a load of money for, you know, Deutsche Bank, they shouldn't be getting their £20 million bonuses then. Oh, no, that's all right. All right, okay, so that's all right. It's because these are working class lads. They shouldn't be getting paid millions of pounds, which is what it comes down to, really, doesn't 100%. It? It's all about that.
Correct.
Yes. Yeah. There's a lot of that involved in there. So I don't think it's going to be end of days. I think everyone was saying end of days when the Bosman rule arrived. But I think there will be a reckoning as far as what the transfer system is going to be. Now, a lot of people rely on the transfer system. A lot of people owe their livelihoods to the whole thing of the transfer system. And I don't just mean ITK social media accounts. I mean actual people who actually do work, who actually do know what's going on in it. And I think a lot of people might say, well, actually, I'm not going to shed a tear if a few agents suddenly end up a little bit poorer because they're not getting a cut of transfers. But they will earn lots more money. They'll earn significant amounts of money when contracts become something else. But what they become, we don't know. But it's certainly something worth keeping an eye on. If this had been 3 or 4 years ago, would you have seen Harry Kane go on strike at Tottenham? Maybe you might have done. Behind the scenes, but who knows? I think now is the time, if you want to go on strike, if you want to try and manoeuvre, all you've got to do is point at Lassana Diarra and say, well, if this guy gets his 65 million euros, then I can't wait for my payday. There's something I think we're going to keep an eye on anyway this season and probably in the next few seasons. But hey, instead of looking at the financial pages, why don't we watch some football this weekend? And what football will we be watching? Well, Terry, Friday night, we'll be sat at home watching some Bundesliga, won't we? Because Sky have decided to put on some Bundesliga this season, haven't they?
Yeah, how much they're going to put on, we're not altogether certain. Their contract expired at the end of last season, but they're still showing it, so they must have done some kind of deal, but we don't know what it looks like. But yes. Bayern Munich versus RB Leipzig will be on the telly on Friday, and I shall be happy to cover that on the box set.
Dortmund St. Pauli as well is on the telly on Saturday evening as well. But yeah, last season, Sky were leaving it to about a week before they actually revealed what games they were doing. But now they've got Sky Plus, then they'll just chuck it up on the red button, won't they?
Well, yeah, my sources tell me that it's not as straightforward as that. And they might not have complete coverage, and it might possibly be shared. But I don't know anything more than that. Nah. And my sources might be wrong.
Yeah, well, Serie A is returning to our screens as well. TNT will be showing Juventus versus Parma this weekend. Oh, obviously, you can get it if you've got DAZN as well now as well, because they will be showing. Yeah, okay, Terry, yes, boo-boo, DAZN, yes. As well as the Levante versus Barcelona on Disney+. I mean, there you go, it's just like the good old days. Remember we were saying at Christmas about how there'll be less football on telly, but now look. If you have the right subscription packages, and if you have a lot of subscription packages, then you can still watch all these football games. Yeah, you do need quite a few, though, don't you, Ian?
You do. I seem to have quite a few as well.
Well, that's quite handy then, isn't it?
It's worked out quite well, even though it's not the way I kind of engineered it, but there you go.
And if you want to see what we think of the 7 games we think you should be watching between Friday and Sunday, then get along to sofpodcast.com and click on the link for the weekend box set. There you'll see a link to our Substack, where you can subscribe, and it will be in your inbox on Friday lunchtime. Yes, it will. But that is all we have time for this week. So, from me, Graham Sibley, from Jan Bilton, and from Terry DeFellin, it's goodbye.
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 Get in touch with us on Blue Sky or Instagram, where we are at Sound of Football, or go to sofpodcast.com. Like us, share us, rate us and review us. Do it now!
Wish lad had ye gone to tell ye all about the story. Wish lad had ye gone to tell ye about the home.
The Lambton worm. Worm is an old English thing. It means like beast or serpent. It doesn't mean worm. Anyway, this guy finds this funny looking fish, thinks nothing of it, chucks it down a well, goes off to the Crusades like you do. In the meantime, this worm turns into this beast and starts going around eating cattle and children. He comes back and goes, oh, this is terrible, buys himself a suit of armour with spikes on it, lets the worm wrap himself around him, and it dies. And so the T4 was a picture of him slaying the beast and saving the people of Northumbria. The sad thing is, though, to find out how to kill the beast, he had to accept the advice of a wise woman who said, I'll teach you how to kill the beast, but you have to kill the first living person that you see after you've done it. And he saw his father and refused to do it, and apparently the whole Lambton line were cursed from that moment on. Yeah, we all learn it when we're at school, and there's a song that goes along with it, which I sing when I'm drunk, which I'm not going to do now because I'll end up on the pod.
You're not drunk. Yeah,
and I'm also not drunk. I actually sang it in a choir at the Sunderland Empire when I was a boy. With a famous lantern.